Welcome to The Conversation. The Conversation. A space to share the art of an interview.
And for this week's edition of La Conversación, Riot Talks, or The Conversation, as you wish to call this weekly segment, we've got down the line Vanessa Bell. She's an Argentine. She currently gives tours about the architecture of the city, but as far as I know, she's a woman of many talents. Isn't that so, Vanessa?
and actually, I'm both Argentine and English. I'm Anglo-Argentine.
You're both. I mean, you've got dual nationality.
I've got dual nationality. I grew up. My parents met in Paris, and I then lived in England, and I've been coming to Argentina all my life. And then I settled here 7 years ago.
Where were you born?
I was born technically in England, but lived my first 5 years in Paris. And I've been visiting Argentina all my life, so I was lucky to grow up trilingual.
But your parents are from Argentina, both of them?
My mother is Argentine and my dad is English.
Ah, okay. Well, yeah. a child of the world. A woman of the world. Well, but you're currently established in Buenos Aires.
I am indeed, yes.
And this is the city you call home.
This is the city I called home, and I continue to do so. And it'll be, in February, it'll be 7 years, and I'm happier than ever here. So.
Great. I'm glad to hear that, because recently I've been talking to a lot of, you're not exactly an expatriate, but many people who established in Buenos Aires over the past decade or more, and the majority of them are thinking or planning to go home. But I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah.
Well, Vanessa, what is exactly your occupation, your profession? I mean, do you study here? Do you work? You have an enterprise? You're an entrepreneur?
I guess a bit of all of that. I came here 7 years ago and I did an internship for Time Out magazine. And I was lucky that I was working on the guidebook. So I got 3 big articles to write for that. And then I started freelancing, and I also did an English teaching course, as so many expats tend to do. It's a guaranteed source of income. Mm-hmm. It's very sociable. And in fact, I continue to do that, but more in keeping with my interests. So I teach gallerists and creatives and people who are more in a creative field or an artistic field. So that I continue to teach. And then about 4 years ago, I set up my own business, organizing made-to-measure tours of the city, and always with an emphasis on showing the sort of the back streets, whatever it was that I was doing. It started out being shopping tours, and that has now diversified. I do interior design consulting, I do architecture tours, I'm now starting with art tours, and it's always this idea, and fashion tours, which is how it started. Mm-hmm. And I always put this emphasis on being able to show people these hidden gems of the city and the non-tourist view. It's almost paradoxical. It's a tourist I suppose it's geared towards tourism, but it's very untouristy.
Yeah. What you call the off the beaten path attractions.
That's exactly it. I've co-written the wallpaper guidebook to Buenos Aires, and I write for a lot of very established design, architecture, and lifestyle magazines.
Good.
Internationally.
Well, I'm going to love this talk, because I'm a big enthusiast of Buenos Aires as a city, as an attraction, as a city to visit and to discover myself. And I like when the hidden gems of Buenos Aires are brought to the surface. For those of you guys, listeners out there, I'm sure you can relate to the city you live or the cities you have visited. There's always like the 1, 2, 3, 4 highlights that nobody can miss. But every city, and Buenos Aires certainly is one of them, has got its hidden places. First, what would be, like, in your opinion, Vanessa, the 3 top, I mean, the most cliche but unmissable stops in any Buenos Aires tour?
Of any kind of tour?
Yeah, let's start with the cliches, and then we'll focus on the on the gems.
I think the cliches are Recoleta Cemetery. I think everybody goes there. you could maybe include the Congress or the Plaza de Mayo, the Pink House, the Pink Palace.
Mm-hmm.
What would be a third? I mean, I suppose maybe not an architectural highlight, but a steakhouse, a Parisia, mm-hmm. or a Milonga.
Or go to Caminito, La Boca, maybe there.
Oh, La Boca, sorry, yes, of course, La Boca. You see, I don't even have La Boca on my radar because I just never take people there.
Yeah. Now, what about the off the beaten path, the things that are gorgeous, are interesting, but the majority of foreign visitors just look over?
Okay, well, I think that although it's in quite an accessible place, I would say the Palace of Running Waters, or Palacio de Aguas Corrientes, mm-hmm. Is an absolute masterpiece. It takes up a whole block, and it was originally a water pumping station. It's got a very interesting history because I think about 30,000, it's either 30,000 or 300,000 tiles were made, commissioned to Royal Doulton and shipped over from England, these ceramic tiles that covered it. I think that's an amazing story, and not many people know it exists. And then I think some of the lesser known works by the Argentine architect Claudine Dotesta. The naval hospital in Caballito. Caballito is a very safe neighborhood. But not many tourists make it there.
Mm.
So I think that's an interesting building that looks like it's got porthole windows. It looks like a ship in honor of the fact that its function is a hospital mm-hmm. for the naval, ex-naval community. It's not really touristy.
Sorry, since you mentioned Clorindo, what about his jewel in the Microcentro, which is the former Bank
yes,
of
the
London.
Bank of the
that is, that, is,
a,
that is incredible. That is.
And actually, what's great about that is when I do my architecture tours, if I have a tour in the week, I obviously take them inside, and whilst they can't photograph, they can walk around the ground floor, and I think that in itself is an incredible experience.
I mean,
it still functions as a working bank.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean the building dates from the.
I think it's the early 60s, I think. But I mean, like many of, we could go on to this, but what's so fascinating about a lot of the architectural builds, certainly from the 60s onwards, is that many of them were stalled due to military junta and not completed. I mean, the Clodine de Tester's library was not inaugurated until 92.
Yes.
But the project started in the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think that's so interesting. You get this really, these movements that were sort of, very late on, you know, brutalism into the 80s and 90s is quite extraordinary.
As far as I remember reading, I mean, of course, you might be a lot more informed than I am about this, but I think that Clorindo's works in Buenos Aires are world class in terms of architecture.
They
are like the architectural pieces that put Argentina on the architectural global map, if I'm not wrong.
Well, and actually, I mean, I write more and more about architecture, but my Twitter, as much as my Instagram, is there's a lot of cityscapes and a lot of I took lots of photos of different buildings, different architectural styles. My Twitter became a real platform to be able to show and to document and to share a lot of the lesser known works of architects here, but Clorindo Testa especially. And I have some very renowned people who have a lot of followers on Twitter who have consistently reposted things that I put, and the response I get has been amazing. And so it's really made, you know, people have put me on the map as, you know, a reference for Argentine architecture, but it's made me realize that, you know, it's world, as you say, world class is a good description. It stands out and stands out among some of the best examples of brutalism. But also because I feel that here we were far enough removed that we had a sort of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And a freedom in terms of budget as well, because of course Argentina has had its various, eras of, you know, golden eras where money's not really been an issue.
Yeah. Tell me about it.
in both extremes, both, you know,
yeah, of course,
bankruptcy
of course.
And an affluence that's, you know, unrivaled, really.
Well, I mean, we can refer to the so-called Belle Époque era, like the end of the 19th
yeah.
century, early 20th century. Most of the buildings that have earned this city, this Argentine capital, the nickname of the Paris of the South. I don't know if it deserves that.
Well,
funny you should
say that, although it is absolutely extraordinary, and I love the Art Deco that there is in the city. Of course, it's hard not to love the Belle Époque era. There are some extraordinary buildings. But I think that I have sort of made it my mission to try and sort of destructure or at least, expand a bit on this cliche, or to say, well, there's so much more to this city than just sort of Belle Epoque. There's just an incredible modernist backstory, the brutalism, and in later decades, obviously postmodernism. There's some extraordinary, again, you know, eras where there's been a lot of money and private residential projects where you have the most extraordinarily strange and eccentric houses.
As somebody who reads, who interprets a city and how it changes and it evolves, what do you think of the two most recent examples of gentrification in Buenos Aires, namely Puerto Madero and the Palermo area?
In terms of, so obviously with, for example, my shopping tours, it's inevitable that I do take people to Palermo, but I think that like any gentrified area, I mean, obviously Palermo, I was coming here in the early 2000s, and Palermo was quite a gritty area to be in. Whilst there was the odd cool little cafe and the odd restaurant and the odd clothes shop, you know, it was badly illuminated and it was unsafe to be around. The change has been enormous. So I think obviously gentrification always has its advantages. But of course, it gets to the point where it drives out a degree of the kind of bohemian and the artistic that makes it what it is. And, you know, my view of Palermo now, it's like a sort of glorified open-air shopping mall. Mm. And I think that is a fair appraisal of it. But, of course, it's always going to attract tourism. It's going to always attract new restaurants and new enterprises. As for Puerto Madero, I think that, as I understand it, I don't remember, Puerto Madero was quite run down and disused, and it was industrial, and it's been reshaped. I think anything that can help swell and encourage tourism and also the locals to use these areas in a different way is welcome. I just think, you know, it's like anywhere, the places get burnt out, and you could say the same for areas of New York and London. So I think it's a natural evolution and a phenomena that happens globally.
Yes, yes. And now that we mentioned Palermo, in Palermo and in many other neighborhoods in Buenos Aires, you can find that very distinctive type of house that many say are that type of house is the real, like, porteño contribution to architecture, if you want, which is the chorizo house, or so-called the sausage house. What can you tell us about that?
What can I tell you in terms of?
I don't know. I mean, do you think it's like a really a very distinctive thing, or we are just exaggerating it's a very common type of house?
No, I think it is a very distinctive Porteño feature, and I think that it is very emblematic. And I think I basically and have been now for about 6 months. I go for regular architecture walks to do research every weekend, and I go to different areas and neighborhoods that are perhaps less well known or less even explored by Porteños. Mm-hmm. And it is a unifying feature that appears in all of these neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. So I think, as you say, it's a fair appraisal that it is something that kind of, you know, is a unifying feature that joins all these neighborhoods together, and you can tell you're in Buenos Aires.
I'm gonna take advantage of the fact that I've got somebody who's completely bilingual down the line, and assuming that we've got many listeners that never came to Buenos Aires, they don't know what a chorizo house is. If you could explain to them in a nutshell what a chorizo or sausage house is.
It's, as far as I understand it, it's a property that's all on one level, and often the entrances have a long, am I right in saying a long corridor, and then often have an exposed patio, external patio with different doors that join onto it. So is that not what you would say is the fair description of it?
Mm-hmm. It's perfect. I mean, that's what I
wanted.
And it tends to be
residential. What's nice is that they're very self-contained and they're residential, but you often have either a terrace or this open air area that joins all the rooms together.
Yeah,
which
yeah.
is such a nice feature, and yeah. I don't think I've seen it much in other countries.
Oh yeah, I agree. I haven't, and I think it's very that kind of house. I mean, I, as a middle class porteño, somebody who grew up in the greater Buenos Aires, I've never been to a Belle Epoque palacete or a petit hotel, but I'm totally familiar with chorizo houses. I've been to several of them. My friends live there, a grandmother there, a tia over there. I mean, everybody's been to or lived in a chorizo house, so yeah, I think it is very emblematic.
Yes,
Now, speaking about other, areas to be discovered, what about the industrial south of Buenos Aires? Do you go there with tours? Barracas, Pompeya?
So, it's one of these things that as I become more and more intrepid with the kind of tours I offer, I'm getting more and more adventurous clients. I'm getting more clients who are designers or involved in the arts or architects. And I'm getting people who are seasoned travelers. And actually, recently I had a couple who were, a couple from Hollywood, in fact. I'm not going to name who they were, but they were established in Hollywood. And they had wanted to see, you know, I think I'm realizing you can never underestimate a client. Because actually, often, someone who hires me wants something that's off the beaten track. For example, I took a couple from New Zealand recently who were architects to see lobbies and murals in Onse. And Onse is, and you know, as you know, Onse is an area where it's the sort of the fabric area where you can get things at wholesale. It's not a particularly touristy area. It's not a particularly nice area, but there's some incredible apartment blocks with really lovely and interesting murals in the lobbies. And so they were quite happy and they were accompanied by me and they didn't seem at all put off by the fact that I was taking them to Onse. In the same way, I in my architecture walks do go to places like Ramos Mejia and I go to Pompeya because there's a lot of nice antiques places where you can pick up, you know, as you know, bric-a-brac and secondhand. There's a Salvation Army. But have I taken clients? Yeah, I think the problem is, as you know, Buenos Aires is so spaced out that you could just probably do a tour there. You know, it's there's only so much time I have, and most tours are anywhere from 4 or 5 hours to a full day.
Yeah.
So I do tend to obviously take them to non-touristy areas, but I tend to gravitate around the center. So maybe I'll take them to Abastor, I'll take them to Onse, I'll take them to Caballito. Caballito is a good example of a neighborhood that's really not explored by tourists, and yet it's safe and it's residential.
Let me take you to a more general issue, but still related to tourism, to traveling. Do you think Buenos Aires has what it takes to become like a world-class destination, including customer service and the way we treat visitors? Because every time I travel abroad and come back to Buenos Aires, I realize how behind we are in that regard.
Okay, I think a good example is the way that the food industry works, or certainly the hospitality industry in terms of restaurants and bars. I think that I come, certainly being English and having grown up in the UK, and perhaps have a degree of, I'm diplomatic, I would say, and I think I've had to become, I've maintained my diplomacy here in terms of this, but there is definitely the case that you are abroad and the customer is always right. And I think you could probably agree with this, that often you'll go to a bar here or you'll complain about something, it doesn't always feel like the customer's always right.
No.
And the customer is always right. You know, that is the kind of pervading line if you go to a world-class city, I think. Mm-hmm. There's a kind of degree of arrogance sometimes where they're doing, the wait staff are doing you a favor, or you feel like you're having to send smoke signals to get the bill. The amount of times I've gone up to the cash till to pay, you know, I've lost count. So I think those things do, you know, and also that, you know, we've all heard the story of the tourist who's been given the runaround by a taxi driver, you know, taking them the scenic route.
Yes.
And those things are, you know, me, sometimes my clients don't take a chauffeur, they opt for the taxi. But by taking a taxi and me being in the car and being bilingual, I'm always watching where the taxi driver's taking us. I'm vigilant. I'm protecting tourists on so many other levels. It's not just them taking a tour. It's me being a sort of angel to a degree, you know, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Well,
because I'm still giving them a kind of undercover as much as I can back street. So I'm giving them access to places, perhaps areas that they wouldn't have, or, you know, going into showrooms or houses or even private residences. It would be very difficult for them to arrange on their own, but they might also be a bit scared to do it. They wouldn't. It's an uncertain entity, an unknown entity, whereas where they're with someone who speaks fluent English, they can relax a bit more.
Yeah. And you work mainly with, I suppose, I mean, English and French speaking foreigners, and how do they get in touch with you? How do they discover your services?
The majority of my clients come from the States. I had a couple of really good write-ups in, I had a write-up in GQ Australia, Elle Australia, and I had a big piece in their biggest, in New Zealand's biggest architecture and design magazine called Urbis. They did a big piece on me. So I've been getting also in, I don't know if you know, but I think it's New Zealand Airlines recently launched a direct flight to Buenos Aires. So there are more Australian and New Zealand tourists. I get a lot from New Zealand and Australia, the Antipodes. I get a lot from Europe. But I guess it's mainly the States and Australasia.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Where can people find? Do you have a website, or how can people get in touch?
I have a website. I also work with agencies here on the ground, bespoke and curated agencies internationally. My company is called Creme de la Creme, and I have a website. So it's cremedelacremeba.com.
Excellent. Well, Vanessa, thank you very much. This has been very interesting. And you made it quite easy, because, I mean, I love architecture, but being a radio host, it's always difficult to talk about architecture because you can't show it. But you're so good explaining that you made it very, very pleasant and very educational. Thank you very much.
It's been lovely to chat to you. Bye.
That was Vanessa Bell, a Anglo-French Argentine. She's a tour guide, a writer here in Buenos Aires, knows a lot about the architecture of this great city where our studios are located. And this was another edition of The Conversation.
A weekly interview to deeply go into understanding the interesting anecdotes, emotions, ideas, dreams, and projects of the most prominent personalities in all fields. The Conversation, a totally different space. A wry proposal, Argentina to the world.